We'll call the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum yet. We're waiting on a couple more members, so we'll wait to approve the minutes, but I think we'll get started with taking the testimony. Before then, I would just like to let everybody know that tomorrow's meeting, we are going to cancel that to continue working on some of the budget numbers. Met with the governor's, visiting with the governor's office, also had the department in yesterday. Representative Eakin and I were in discussions as well. So I think we'll take that time tomorrow to zero in on this. We're very, very close. We're putting this together. And then the following week, picking it up on Tuesday, we will have a delete all and then zero in on that and have the bill moved out by the end of the week. So, all right, that's the plan. And like I said, Representative Eakin has been very instrumental in these conversations as well. I'd also like to just express my disappointment to Ms. Conley for not showing up with a PowerPoint presentation and talk about her polar plunge and in costume as well. We were hoping you'd show up in costume, so I just wanted to get that on record. I'm just teasing. So hopefully it was a success. So with that, members, first what we'll do is we'll ask Mr. Clavin to come forward. I know the turkey growers are in town, and you have some other obligations, so we thank you for being here. If you'd like to start us off today, we have a number of folks that wanted to learn more about the pass-through grants. As far as who you are, what you do, tell us a little bit about them and the reason why they're important. And so if we'll just be able to answer those questions, starting with you, Mr. Clavin, if you would state your name for the record, who you represent, and begin, please.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent the Minnesota Turf Seed Council, and that's a group of farmers and processors up in northern Minnesota, up in the corner. Just quickly, a little funding history on this project. In 2005 was the first year we got an appropriation through the ag budget, and that was $130,000 for varietal research on different kinds of grasses. Bluegrass, Kentucky bluegrass, switchgrass, perennial rye, and so forth. That started in 05. In 07, that appropriation was renewed at 130, but there was a second one added that year, and if you remember, there was a lot of conversation about renewable energy and biomass and so forth. And so in 2007, there was a second appropriation added for $200,000, and that was on yield and biomass characteristics. It wasn't technically out of the Next Gen Fund, although it was related to the conversation. In 2009, the 130 was renewed for the third time on the varietal research. The biomass was cut in half from 200 to 100. And some of this might have got a haircut during the unallotment, but I don't remember. But that's the bill funding history for the last three bienniums. We have some growers who normally would come down, but they kind of punted and gave me their testimony. And this is bits and pieces from the 2009 testimony that was presented here from the last round of funding. They want to point out a couple of things about this project. The first research was done on this back in 1948 through an Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Commission appropriation. And the reason that was done that year was the Magnuson family in Roseau donated parts of their farm for research to the university, which are still in existence today. It's the northernmost outpost for research in the state and I think the country. And that's on the Magnuson farm, and they did that appropriation way back then. They've developed a number of varieties over the years, bluegrass, reed canary, red top, red clover, and so forth. A lot of this has gone over the years to high-end markets like golf courses and so forth. The industry up there has some seed processing companies. There are 50 workers that work in Lake of the Woods and Roseau counties to clean the seed and so forth. Two of the companies are privately owned and one is a producer cooperative. They also want to point out the production of these grass seeds is environmentally friendly, because the seed, once it's planted, is there for 4 or 5 years, and the soil isn't disturbed. Back in 02, up in the valley, there was 10 inches of rain, and of course, if you've been up there, it's quite flat. 10 inches of rain kind of stays there for a while. And there was gullies and so forth, but not on the grass seed fields, because the grass held it down. So they experienced that on their research plots. A couple of the project focuses here. They are trying to develop perennial turf grass and forage varieties for germplasm for the seed production that will be for the following crops and legumes as well. They have also been asked by the industry, the using industry, to develop grass varieties that use less nitrogen and less water. And we have that conversation generally in ag on corn and the rest of it, that we're being asked to do more with less. We have people that want to try to restrict our nitrogen use, and of course you all know that that's what plants eat. You have to feed them nitrogen and apply it. And so they're trying to develop those varieties. There are some experiment plots I want to point out that have been developed with this. They are located in Grand Rapids, Roseau, Crookston, Red Lake Falls, and Manoman. And so the southernmost one is Manoman. Representative Eakin is probably not too far from that. There's also a little bit in Fargo and South Dakota, and that's just to spread out the geographic locations. I think the final point, Mr. Chairman, I do have some technical stuff here. It involves some Latin, and I really don't want to get into, but if you want to see some technical stuff from the researchers I brought it with, probably the final point on this pass-through is that when you look at the history going back to 48, and in particular for this committee starting in 05, if you pull the plug now, all the years and money you've already invested will be kind of wasted. And some of the others may not have that, but on this project we'd ask you to consider that aspect as well. And Mr. Chairman, I'll do my best to answer the questions on the on the industry for you.
Any questions for the testifier members? Any questions? So, well, you did a very good job explaining it. So we appreciate that. We know how to get a hold of you as well if we have any questions in the future. Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have a spreadsheet of the pass-through grants available?
We do. Let's make copies of that. We'll have copies made.
So we kind of keep this conversation in context as we go through the morning.
Very well. Very well. We'll get some copies made. So, and I apologize for not having that in your folders that came to me this morning. We do have a quorum as of 10:24, so let's look for somebody to approve the minutes. Representative McElfatrick approves the minutes, or makes a motion to approve the minutes for March 15th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, next we'd like to call up Julie Tesh. Ms. Tesh, if you'd like to come up and talk to us about MEALC. So welcome. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and begin, please.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Julie Tesh, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council. Otherwise, it's a mouthful. We'll refer to it as MEALC from now on. Just to give you a quick background on MEALC, MEALC is a 17-member legislative council that was created in 1997, dedicated to improving and restructuring agricultural education in the state of Minnesota at all levels. Preschool through adult learners benefit from the critical knowledge provided by agricultural education programs. From basic food systems knowledge to advanced processing sciences, agriculture is the key to one of four jobs in Minnesota, which I'm sure you all are aware of. Only with sufficient agricultural education can the state continue to grow and prosper. The members of our board include from various public, private, and governmental entities, and these members are agribusiness leaders, teachers, legislators, and other people interested in agricultural education. I just want to share with you our mission statement briefly, in that it's very simple. MEALC provides leadership to expand and grow agricultural education in Minnesota, and we have two guiding principles, is that Minnesota is stronger when people understand the importance of agriculture, and that it is important for agricultural education to serve both youth and adults. When we're talking about pass-through dollars, in 2007, this committee and the legislature allocated $250,000, an additional $250,000 to be used for pass-through, and that was for grants throughout the state of Minnesota to deal with agricultural education. In 2010, that amount was reduced to $235,000 per year. The grants that we've awarded have had a great impact on agricultural education. Because of the funding, we have been able to educate more citizens about the importance of ag, food, and natural resource education in Minnesota. And our grants are basically broken down into four areas, and that is secondary education, post-secondary education, farm business management education, and agricultural literacy. And I'm not sure how much detail you want me to go into. I can go into a great amount of detail, but I'll just highlight kind of those four areas. If you recall back a few weeks ago, we had an agricultural literacy hearing here, and those teachers and those students are a direct impact of some of our grant dollars. The school gardening programs, the ag education that goes on in those schools, those are directly funded. Those are some grants funded by MEALC. So without these dollars, we would not be able to work with the school districts as much. When we're talking about secondary education, we've been able to provide grants to help and support and expand our agricultural education at secondary levels. And just to let you know some numbers, in Minnesota we have 187 secondary programs. We reach over 32,000 students, and we have 226 teachers. Just a little something for you to note is that back in 1985, we did have more programs. We had 254 programs, but we were only reaching 12,000 students, where now we have 187 programs, and we're reaching over 32,000 students. So we're getting a great bang for our buck here. A couple things in secondary education: these grants have been able to provide a statewide curriculum called CART, which is the Center for Agricultural and Environmental Research. They have been able to provide us with online curriculum for all of our licensed teachers in Minnesota that teach agricultural education. And the online curriculum and assessment piece covers animal science, plant science, soil science, natural resource science, and biological applications in agriculture. And all of these curriculums crosswalk the science standards in Minnesota. So if they use this curriculum, you'll be able to test which strand or where you're at on science credit. Also, Minnesota was a pilot state for a National Quality Program Standard grant through FFA and agricultural education, and because of that, we were able to provide a grant for that. We also have done work with the Council on Economic Education. You can take an ag economics class if you take training for the Council on Economic Education and receive economic credit. So that grant has been able to work with them on that. And also we've been able to work with some consortiums and cooperative education groups around the state and work with the Minnesota FFA. When we talk about post-secondary education, we're trying to recruit and retain high-quality students to be ag teachers. We have a shortage. We'd like to have more teachers. And so one of the programs that we help fund is the teacher induction program. We know that being in the teaching industry that the first 3 to 5 years of teaching is where we lose the most teachers. But with the teacher induction program, we provide a grant to the University of Minnesota to help retain those teachers, and it has been very successful so far, and we actually have a very high retention rate. So that is a grant. We're also part of a national research study. Excuse me, Minnesota Ag Education has not been a part of a national research study in at least 10 to 15 years. And so part of this grant money is going to fund a national research study on science integrating into agricultural education. And so we have 40 schools participating. The ag teacher partners up with their science teacher, and we will be able to provide data this fall showing if ag education indeed does provide those science standards. So we're excited about that. And then also in the northwestern part of the state, we've been able to start a sparsely populated project. It's a very, obviously we all know it's a very rural part of the state, but a lot of their schools do not have ag education. And so we have an innovative program going up there where we have three pods. So we have four schools in each pod, and they're able to be in the FFA, they're able to have ag education, and they actually do some online learning. Farm business management, the grants that we've worked on with them, farmers need curriculum too. They need to know how to do their book work. We have 70 instructors that work with over 3,000 farm families, and we've been able to provide grants to work on enhancing their curriculum, upgrading their curriculum, putting some of it online. And then also we know that we have retirements coming, and it is proven that when we can provide the new instructor coming in and working with the outgoing instructor, that we can keep at least 80% of the clients or farmers working with them. And then when we talk about agricultural literacy, we're also talking about recruiting students to be teachers. Then we're talking about we have a grant with South Minneapolis, Key Waden and Winona Schools, and they have integrated agriculture completely into their curriculum. And so that has been something that we're hoping to replicate. So, and then finally I want to mention we have been able to award a lot of competitive grants to our ag programs through classroom upgrades. I don't know if many of you have been in an ag classroom in the last 5 years, but they're usually the last ones to get upgraded and updated. And so because of this, we've been able to provide grants to provide smart boards and some other interactive technology so that our students do not fall behind. And what we found out with our online curriculum is that access was an issue. So we've been able to provide some computers, some technology for them as well. And so we've been able to keep our students engaged that way. So with that, I will take any questions.
Ms. Tesh, we do have a few questions. First, what's your total budget?
For the pass-through dollars, our total budget is $235,000 per year, and then we have money coming through the Ag Special because we're housed at the University of Minnesota, and so that is another $243,118.
Okay.
So our total budget is $478,118. Excuse me, I just want to mention these pass-through dollars that we're talking about today, none of that goes towards operating. It all basically goes right out into competitive grants. And projects like I was highlighting. It's our operating budget comes through the Ag Special, and then we have some scholarships and grants that come through that as well.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Tesh, I was interested when you mentioned Northwest Minnesota and the pod program that you've got going on up there. Three pods and four schools in each pod, you were saying. I was wondering if I could just get a little more information on what schools were in the pods and how it works, if there's a central location where the program is taking place or if it rotates, if you could answer that. Thanks.
Ms. Tesh.
Representative Eakin and committee, very good question. This is actually an innovative grant or an innovative concept that came about from Dr. Lyle Westrom at the University of Minnesota Crookston. So we've worked with him and with Northland Community College, and last year was the first year that we did this. They did a feasibility study, and they started in our first pod, I believe, if I can remember, we had War Road, we had Lake of the Woods, I traveled up to their school, and then we had three schools last year, and then we had, I believe, it was Norman County West. Our hope is that from this, that Norman County West will spin off and have their own Ag Ed program. That would be ideal, is that they'll each break off and end up having their own program. What we're doing is helping these schools provide some curriculum and technology. So what ends up happening is, so those three schools share a teacher. The teacher is actually physically in the classroom one day a week. Otherwise, it's online learning. The students are provided with a computer, and then they do their online things there. But then one day a week, they do their labs, and they're with that teacher. So we're tweaking it. It's not perfect in any way, but this year we do have three pods, and I right now I can get back to you on what the other two pods are, but they're going well. Some teachers do well teaching online, some students do well learning online, others don't. And so what we're finding out is that if we're going to be our goal is that we provide more ag education in a more strategic way. So when you take Minnesota and divide it in half, we know that those are sparsely populated areas, the western half. So we need to start training teachers who can do more online education better. And so that's something that we're looking at right now, because we really do believe that this is something that we need to look at in the future. It's cost effective, but getting and the schools are willing to buy into it a little easier because it's not requiring them to pay for a teacher with benefits and everything. So they're kind of sharing in a consortium type way.
Thank you. Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the testimony on Mailsey, and I know that a number of folks around the table here have been big supporters. And, Mr. Chair, I think I have more of an observation than a question. Certainly this program, I think you and I both share an affinity for and want to see this funded, and I know we've just got this sheet with all of these programs that we're going to be hearing about today, and I know that we're all going to be facing some tough choices as we look at these. So I think as testifiers come to the table, we probably would say the low-hanging fruit in terms of budget cuts, all deference to Representative Shemansky aside, is probably gone. So I would just note that the difficulty of the choices, and I'm glad Ms. Tesh mentioned the Ag Specials. I mean, we need to continue that discussion, Mr. Chair. I tried yesterday in higher ed to do something for Ag Specials, and I know that we need to continue this conversation of where the best place to fund ag programs should emanate from, because I'm not so sure that this isn't the best committee to deal with ag funding. And that's more an observation than a question.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. Representative Anderson, Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I, too, would echo the sentiments of my colleagues that I think this needs to be a priority for our committee and for our state to teach our folks about agriculture. the some of the programs we heard about coming into the inner cities has just been outstanding to get our message out there. And also the part about jobs and education, ag education teachers, to keep our rural people up to speed on things and to also provide jobs back in our rural areas is so important. And I think programs like this go a long ways to help keeping our rural areas strong and vibrant. So thanks, Ms. Tesh, and I certainly support programs such as this.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Bruce Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Still early.
Thank
Still
you, Mr.
Early.
Chair. You'll get there soon enough. Ms. Tesh, you mentioned in your testimony something about you're now at 32,187 programs. I missed the first part of where you started out at. What were those figures?
Ms. Tesh.
Representative Anderson, committee. Just to go over those numbers again, currently we have 187 high school programs, so secondary programs. We have 226 teachers. Some of our schools have two or three teachers, which is wonderful. That is just absolutely wonderful. And we reach approximately 32,200 students, grades 7-12. When you go back to 1985, when we had 254 secondary programs, we were only reaching 12,766 students. So we've decreased the number of programs, unfortunately, but we have almost tripled how many students we're reaching. And you can look at that in a lot of different ways, increase class sizes, things like that, but it goes to show that students are really excited about ag education. And just a little side note, in Forest Lake, they have a three-teacher department. Their most senior teacher is retiring, and they had their FFA banquet last night, and it was very nice. And quite honestly, because of budget cuts, we did not think that they would fill that position. But there is such demand at their school for these ag programs that they are going to rehire that position. So we were very happy about that. And so the demand is there from the students.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Tesh. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you for coming to the committee as well. We will call up Ms. Eggert from Minnesota Horticulture Society. We'll ask you to come up next. And on deck, then, we'll have Mr. Molinar from Minskew. So, please, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, who you represent, and begin, please.
Good morning, and thank you. My name is Rose Eggert, and I'm representing the Minnesota State Horticultural Society. And I've got with me Vicki Vogels, who is our community outreach coordinator also.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to speak on the mission of the organization, and then Vicki will speak again on our community outreach programs. The mission of the Minnesota State Horticultural Society is to serve northern gardeners through education, encouragement, and community. Our current goals include providing Minnesotans with the knowledge and materials to grow their own food, becoming a resource on sustainability, and increasing our community outreach programs. We are one of the largest horticultural societies in the United States with over 13,000 members and subscribers. For over 145 years, the Society has been a resource for northern gardeners throughout the state of Minnesota. We provide the following resources to our members as well as to the general public. We are the publishers of Northern Gardener magazine, formerly known as Minnesota Horticulturist. It is edited exclusively for cold climate gardening, and it has the distinction of being the longest continually published magazine in the state of Minnesota. All members and subscribers receive Northern Gardener, and it also is available at over-the-counter bookstores, garden centers, statewide and region-wide.
And excuse me, and members, I think you all have a copy.
You all have a copy, yes.
Thank you.
We are the home of the largest circulating garden library in the state with over 2,000 garden books, DVDs, and CDs. We provide these resources to the general public and our members. We provide weekly educational programs on gardening in this challenging climate that we have. In the Northern Gardener that you have, you'll see the list of all the programs that we provide. We also provide presentations at the Spring Home and Garden shows and at the Home and Patio show that just occurred. On the Northern Gardener that you have, there's a cover wrap, and that cover wrap contains over 130 discount partners that we work with, and they offer a benefit of a discount by our members shopping with them. And what we do is we bring our members bring and sustain these Minnesota businesses. We have since the 1930 we have the 1930s we have developed a garden club program, and today we have 130 statewide garden clubs that are affiliated with our organization, and over 2,000 people belong to the garden clubs. These garden clubs provide time, energy, enthusiasm, knowledge, and financial donations to plant and maintain public garden spaces. These clubs also support horticultural students with scholarship funds and educate children and the public with the rewards of gardening. We support these districts by a district support fund, and this district support fund, for every garden club member, we give back to the district a dollar to help support their efforts in their communities. We have over 3,300 volunteer hours logged each year on with our volunteers, and we would not be able to do our mission without the support of our many volunteers. We've seen an increase in volunteers due to the many people who are out of work right now, and they want to be able to keep their resumes active, and they feel value in what we're doing, and so they want to support our mission. Vicki is going to speak today on our two outreach programs, Minnesota Green and Garden in a Box. And Vicki?
So please, and if you could just state your name for the record, please.
Very good. My name is Vicki Vogels. I'm the Community Outreach Coordinator for the Horticultural Society.
Thank you
for hearing what we have to tell you about our programs today. Minnesota Green is our premier program. It's been around since 1988. And it was a larger program at one time offering more services. But what we do now is have a plant donation program that goes to over 130 groups statewide. And what we do is take plants that would otherwise be composted and thrown out and get them to community spaces, to community gardens, food programs that help feed neighborhoods. One donation alone gets about $584 worth of plant product to a community group. So we work with a lot of local greenhouses and garden centers to filter those kind of plant products to community groups. And again, this probably would just be throwaway if it wasn't for a program like this, because it's rather labor intensive for the company. Some of the type of groups that join this program include cities that had larger budgets in the past and now can benefit from joining and getting their plant product to beautify the communities. Community garden plots, schools join, as do garden clubs, public housing. Many of the Minneapolis public housing programs have joined to get plant and vegetable for their residents. Neighborhood groups, other nonprofits, and religious groups all join Minnesota Green. We just had a fabulous donation of approximately 27,000 packets of seeds, which we are now distributing to food shelves around the state, small programs, large programs, and some of the places that we have been able to get them out to so far include Nashwauk, Minnesota, and counties of Faribault, Martin, and Watawan, I believe is the correct
Watawan. Thank you. That's Representative Torkelson's district.
Thank you.
So you have his vote, right? I'm teasing. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the corrected pronunciation. And I just would like to remind everyone that Watawan means good fish bait, which also makes good plant fertilizer.
There you have it.
Currently, we have about 12 counties that are involved in the program. Our Garden in a Box program is a new program. It's been around for about 3 years, and we've been doubling it each year. In that program, we're getting small garden boxes, 3x3s, and soil and small vegetable plants that are cultivated specifically for these small spaces to low-income families so that they are able to start growing fresh produce. The first year, we gave about 50 boxes away. Second year, 100, and this year our goal is 200, providing that we can come up with the funding to do that program. This year we're partnering with other nonprofit organizations to help distribute those. So those are primarily in the metro area, and I'd be happy to share those names with you if you're interested. Next year our intention is to take the boxes to Rochester to try to disseminate in that area, and the third year we'll take them to Duluth. And I just want to mention, we do classes at the Horticultural Society. We also have taken classes up to Duluth and down to Lamberton. So we really try to reach out on a statewide basis where we have the capability. And we have a statewide awards program where we recognize the work of young people getting involved in gardening. So we've got a youth award, we've got a teacher's award, and we're also this year acknowledging the breeders at the state of Minnesota at the university for apple breeding and grape breeding. So for us, it feels like a really important piece to acknowledge and encourage students, teachers, and those who are contributing to their communities in a way that benefits all of us.
Very nice. And what's your total budget?
Our total budget is $857,000.
Right. Very good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. We do have couple questions. Bruce Anderson, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, we had a one of our legislators in last week who was promoting a very controversial issue called hemp, and we're just wondering, if you guys ever get involved with the hemp project?
No.
Ms. Haggard.
No, we have not.
Oh, I thought maybe that was a statewide deal. With since Ms. Representative Kahn was pushing it, it'd be coming down your alley too. So. Anyway, thank you.
Sure. Representative Anderson, Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. You mentioned the garden boxes that were put out the last couple of years. I would assume they'll be used again in coming years. It's not just a one-and-done type thing?
Correct. And so what we hope to do... thank you. What we hope to do is get vegetables to the groups that have... or the families that have received the boxes in the past, as well as getting new box systems out to these new families.
Anderson, thank you. Representative Swazinski, you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Now, do you do like, I hear on the news, like heirloom seeds and some of those things? Could you explain some of that?
We'd like to take that question.
Well, in our office, actually, one of the publisher of our magazine, he goes to Seed Savers Exchange. It's a magazine, and he orders heirloom seed plants, and then he grows them in the office. And then we have a community garden that the Horticultural Society maintains, and we plant heirloom tomatoes. But other than that, we have books in our library on heirloom plants and stuff too.
All right. Thank you. Seeing no other questions, I appreciate your testimony here today.
Okay,
and,
thank you.
Thank you. And we know how to get a hold of you as well if we have further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I'd like to remind the members, we do have a number of testifiers. We did schedule about 10 minutes per testifier, so just trying to work through time management here as well. Mr. Molinar is next, and on deck would be... Rademacher with Minnesota State Poultry Association. So please state your name for the record and who you represent and begin, please.
Thank you, Chairman Hamilton. My name is Jim Molinar. I'm here representing Minnesota State Colleges and Universities Farm Management Education Programs and the Rural Mental Health Support or Outreach Program that has passed through funding. And my work is at Ridgewater College in Wilmer and Hutchinson, Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor to be asked to give testimony. I'll try to be direct, but if you would like to wiggle your finger at me if I'm going overtime, then I'll know. And I appreciate that. As I was walking over this morning, I was observing the beautiful blue sky and the snowbanks melting and thinking about the impact that might have in flood areas when I promptly, this beautiful little puddle that I saw that I thought I could walk through, suddenly found myself in ankle-deep ice water and filled my shoe. It was a deep pothole, not the easygoing experience I was expecting. Having said that, I thought it was interesting that that's how this program started, was with flooding in the Red River Valley area in western Minnesota in the 1990s. Ted Matthews, who offers the Rural Mental Health Program, was a FEMA health counselor for people affected by the flood. And what he observed was that people from all walks of life were coming for counseling and support as a relationship to a natural disaster, but he had no farmers walking into his office on Main Street seeking help. And he thought, that's odd, because surely flooding and disaster must impact farmers. Why is it they're not coming in to see me? He struck up over coffee a partnership with one of our farm management educators. And I hope you're familiar with farm management education. I gave you a one-page handout about that program. Our instructors work with farmers directly, one-on-one, in farmer education. It's part of the college system. 3,000 producers participate, 70 instructors. There are 6 regional areas, which you may recognize someone from your area. Al Brudley is from some of your areas, or Eric Dieters, Delray Lacey, or Rhonda Verkstein, and our system director, Dr. Richard Jorger, system director, is here also. Okay, back to my story. What we found out is that farmers benefited from a different approach. They trusted their farm management instructor, they trusted the farm management program, and when they realized the stress they were feeling was part of farm management, they said, well, I can go talk to someone who will help me with farm management and stress related to my farm. Whereas if we turned that and said, how about you go see a mental health counselor at the hospital, it was seen as something they would not do. But when we integrated as part of a program, suddenly we found that farmers were under stress, did need help with family situations, and of course I could go on and on about what the things they might need help with. But we hit upon a partnership. We were fortunate to receive some grant funding. We made an appeal to the legislature and received some partial funding back in the early 2000s, and we have been funded as a pass-through item, and I believe this would be the 4th biennium if we were approved again. The budget had been $100,000 per year, and it was reduced this past 2-year session to $94,000 as a part of a reduction in state funds. What that money does provide is a full-time, essentially 24-hour-a-day counselor who will answer his cell phone whenever you call him, be it Saturday, Sunday, nights, weekends. His travel expense, his insurance, and what we found is it's a very efficient delivery system compared to what maybe other types of health counseling might be. And so here we are. We've now got about a 15-year history with this program. We've seen some things that have helped people. It's pretty widely accepted through the farm management program that this is a source of help, and it does impact a large number of people and other agencies directly and indirectly. I would just say, you know, one of the questions you might ask me, and if I could anticipate that, you might say, well, how do you measure the impact of this program? And I would say sometimes we can measure how many people are seen or counseled or educated, but sometimes it's hard to measure a disaster averted. In other words, how do you measure someone who doesn't commit suicide because you help them? There's no statistic to prove that out. Although we know that it happens, we had several families this winter that were being counseled. And so, you know, we know that that is out there. I'm not sure I've done a very good job of answering all of your questions, because I could talk for an hour if I tried to anticipate all of them. So I think what I'll do is just stop talking and let you ask questions. Maybe the thing you're wondering about or how I could further explain what you are wondering about regarding this project.
Mr. Molinar, I have two questions. First one, what's the total budget on this program?
The total budget is $94,000.
Okay.
And I would say Ridgewater College and myself, we are the program administrator. We take no dollars out of the funding for overhead or payroll, that type of thing. All the dollars go back to the program. So it's $94,000.
All right. Thank you. And my other question is, we also fund the Farm Crisis Assistance. And are these intertwined in any way that you know of?
You're talking about MINFANS to the Department of Agriculture?
Is through the Mr. Borboom, maybe if you'd like to come down as well. On here, line items, we have the Farm Crisis Assistance and we have the Mental Health Grants. And so Mr. Mullenauer, we'll call up Deputy Commissioner here, Mr. Borboom, to answer the question.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Borboom, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. On your spreadsheet that you have, the Farm Crisis Assistance is actually the Minnesota Farm Advocate Program. That's a program that is one that we administer through our agency. As far as the relationship, I would say that there are nine farm advocates in the state of Minnesota. They are well familiar with the work that Ted Matthews does, and so when there is a need to call on the kind of skill set or talent that Ted brings, they are happy to do that because farm advocates recognize the need and they will make the referrals to people like Ted.
So the next question would be, could the farm advocates, are they trained in any way, shape, or form to help with the mental crisis as well?
Mr. Chairman, members, the level of training is primarily to recognize the need. They are not in the business of doing the analysis or the type of counseling that might be required, but they certainly have attended workshops to recognize the need when there is a need to do referral. They will either refer to TED or to crisis counseling or sow the seeds of hope or some of those types of resources.
So, and again, the question is, are these intertwined, are they overlapping, or are they duplicative of each other?
Mr. Chairman, I would not say that they overlap. I would say that there is a partnership between, like, the farm advocates who work with farm families that are in foreclosure or mediation. When they recognize the need for some mental health counseling, they will simply make the referrals to the appropriate resources, and TED would be an example of that type of resource.
Okay. Thank you. We do have a few other questions. Representative Bruce. Oh, he stepped out. Representative Bruce. Representative Bruce Anderson. Excuse me. Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Molinar, I appreciate the work that you do and certainly understand the pressures that farm families are going through. I remember in our own family some of the pressures we're going through in the 80s, especially when going through the farm crisis of that decade. And I guess my question, and in the Red River Valley, which I represent a portion of, obviously the flood issues being a high-stress issue, not just when the flood's occurring, but there's always that anticipation it could happen any time because we need to do more as far as prevention and protecting those communities from floods. But I just wanted to know if the demand for these services, if you're able to adequately address the demand that's out there from the farm community.
Mr. Molinar.
Chairman Hamilton, and thank you. I guess I don't know you well enough to know your name.
Eakin.
So I apologize. No, we probably can't address the demand that's there. We have one person covering an entire state. Yesterday he was in Winona and back in Morris last night, counseling people. So it is a challenge. On the other hand, we use the resources of our partners, the Department of Ag and so on, and other agencies, the telephone, internet, and so a lot of and then the farm management program itself. And so having, certainly more could be done. But we are certainly happy just to have this resource that when someone has a need, you know, there's a number to call, and the farm manager, educator, or farmer can at least get advice and a referral
So we're probably not meeting all the demand that's there, but I think we're doing a really good job with the dollars that are invested here. So I'm not sure how that answers your question. But if I could add one comment, I may have left the perception this is only needed when there's a disaster or economic crisis. The stresses of farming go far beyond just the crisis. There are family relationships. One of the biggest stressors we see in farmers right now is grain marketing. At FarmFest, I had a farmer come up totally disgusted that corn was below $3 a bushel, and he missed the opportunity and could not sleep at night. Are any of you corn farmers here and aware of what the corn market would be today and the stress involved with knowing when to sell? Because you might sell it at $5 thinking, oh, this is great, it was $3 a month ago. And today it's $6 or almost $7. And so there are pressures and strains that affect people even when there are good financial times. And our livestock farmers are having some real difficulties financially. And that is where a lot of time is going right now. Thank you very much.
Representative Eaton. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Molnar, it's good to see you. And a familiar face from Western Minnesota is always appreciated. My question kind of ties into along the line of question that Representative Eakin had. We typically, I think, understand that rural parts of the state, and specifically farmers, are often underserved when it comes to health care, and even more so when it comes to mental health care. Can you talk a little bit about just where this program picks up some of the gaps that we know exist?
Mr. Molinar.
Chairman Hamilton and Representative, thank you. I wouldn't want to pass myself off as a health care expert or that, you know, my advice. But what I do know is that in order to be serviced through traditional mental health care, you do need a diagnosis to have it paid for with your health insurance. That sometimes can affect a farmer's ability to get life insurance or possibly even down the road financing or to serve in the military. And so that's not necessarily a bad thing if you need help, but there is a stigma where people don't always approach traditional sources of mental health, and nor do traditional sources of mental health understand the complexities of farming. You know, an advice from a typical counselor would be, why do you keep doing this? It's so stressful. And of course, any farmer worth his salt would say, well, what are you talking about? I couldn't ever quit this job. But where we fill in the gaps is people that may have a minor need or a small issue that just with some advice and help can get over that instead of making more poor decisions that might lead them into real trouble. And so we can fill in the gaps. It's a very short time from when someone calls for help to when they receive assistance. There's not a intake process or a process of screening. Anyone that needs help can call Ted Matthews. His cell phone number is on the flyer, so it's immediate. And so I think it does fill a place. As far as health care costs and mental health care costs, we have seen a large increase in one or both of farm family members getting off-farm employment in seeking health care insurance through an off-farm job because the self-employed health care coverage is relatively expensive. I hope I've answered your question and not too many questions beyond your question.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mueller, thank you for that. That's very helpful to know. And just to clarify, too, so I can fully understand this, when a farmer calls, what is the cost of the farmer? Essentially, I understand this to be basically a provided service that really isn't a cost to them.
It is provided as being part of the farm management education program, which is typically about a $1,500 expense for an annual enrollment. And we don't charge an additional fee for the mental health services or a phone call. That is provided to the family. So it's relatively inexpensive to the farm family. Yes. Good question.
Representative Falk. All right. Thank you. Seeing no further. Oh, Representative Vogel. I'm sorry.
Well, I thought I better just chip in, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Mr. Molinar, nice to see you again. And I had an opportunity to go to a meeting that Mr. Molinar had put on back in December, I think it was, after the election. And It was a very good meeting. I appreciate the opportunity to be there, meet some of the people, the farmers who are using the program, and sounded like they were extremely benefited by it, and we appreciate that. I just want to thank you for it. So,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bogle, it's good to see you from my home district, and appreciate those comments.
So, well, thank you. So, thank you. And we have no further comments or questions at this point in time. We appreciate your testimony and coming for the committee.
My contact information is here should you want to follow up or have a need that you'd like to bring to our attention.
Very well. Thank you so much. Right, we do have, I'm going to call up Adrian Rademacher with the Minnesota State Poultry Association, and we're going to move this agenda around a little bit because we do have some people that traveled from out state. So next we'll bring up after this testimony is Mr. Crabtree, and then Polk will be the third one. Okay, so please state your name and who you represent for the record and begin.
Good morning. I have with me the president of the Minnesota State Poultry Association, Paul Merkins.
Welcome.
He's presently serving on the board of managers of the Minnesota State Fair. My name is Adrian Rademacher. I'm secretary-treasurer of the Minnesota Poultry Association. The association is celebrating its 125th anniversary at the 2011 show and have been strong supporters of the youth and states of the state, and particularly the 4-H and FFA programs. We have over 200 members in the association, with many of them serving on local county fair boards and the state 4-H committee. The basic purpose of the association is to promote purebred poultry, especially the heritage breeds, and to educate the youth of the state. In 2010, we received a $1,000 grant through the program administrated by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And by the way, we probably have the smallest budget. We have a budget of $15,000 that we work with on to promote our various projects. The funding we receive helps pay some of the cash awards, trophies at the Minnesota State Poultry Show held in October for well over 2,800 entries. It also goes to along for the cost to pay the cost of judging, liability insurance, and building rent. In the last few years, some of the funding has been used to replace aging equipment used to put on a show. We also have showmanship classes that we pay, award medallions to all the youth of the state. This funding is also used to help pay for all the plaques awarded for the purebred poultry and waterfowl at the Minnesota State Fair for all the breeding classes. Seminars are held for educational purposes to teach the youth on such topics as how to exhibit their poultry, vaccination programs, keeping cost reports, showmanship, and public speaking. Folks, I'd hate to see the various breeds of poultry, purebred poultry and waterfowl, with the numbers running well into 250 different breeds and varieties, disappear like some of the other breeds of animals, such as some of the breeds of hogs that you rarely see, the Berkshires, the Durocs, and the Hamp breeds that you no longer see on family farms. Similar, some of the dairy cattle breeds, such as the Guernseys and Ayrshires that we have, are all but disappearing. What a shame it would be if a decision you folks make regarding all these various animals that have existed in our past for our enjoyment and financial endeavors would all but disappear. Excuse me. Please give some thought about what effect your decisions have on the 4-H programs and the youth of our state. Our young people learn a lot of responsibility from raising animals for their projects, such as public speaking, record keeping, and cost management. At this time, we request that you continue the funding of the Minnesota State Poultry Association, the $1,000, to help offset some of the costs so that we can continue promoting purebred poultry, waterfowl, especially for the youth and 4-H, which we strongly have supported for the past 125 years. Thank you for listening to our concerns. Any questions?
Any questions, members? Mr. Merkins, are you up here for the event, the poultry event as well?
I'm president of the Poultry Association. for the past 15 years probably. We are a nonprofit organization, and we have received funding for a number of years, and this is our $1,000 is what our allotment is. Yeah.
Okay. It, we used to get more, like every other organization we got covered over the years. We've received this funding since back in the early 60s. Okay. And, so and $1,000 doesn't sound a lot to most organizations, but to what we promote, it definitely makes a big difference when your total budget is only $15,000.
Right. And Mr. Rademacher, you said your total budget was $15,000.
Correct.
Just said that.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. Representative Paul Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You picked my interest here talking about some of these older dairy breeds of cattle, Jerseys and Ayrshires. So how do you keep them going? Does somebody have a small breeding herd, or how do you
well,
keep
I,
some
I
of these people
Well, I just use that
going?
As an example when it comes to the dairy cattle. We're the promoters of purebred poultry. Somebody asked about heirloom seeds. Well, the same thing is true with some of the... If you go to the Minnesota State Fair, 95% of the birds are exhibited by members of the Minnesota State Poultry Association. And it's breeds that you normally... Youngsters in town nowadays, if you talk about... We call them birds. There's chickens and there's birds. The birds that we show are heritage birds. They're expensive birds. They're very valuable. A lot of genetics involved in it. And for them to disappear, it would be, you'll never see them again. The average bird that youngsters see nowadays are white. They're either a meat bird, which are about 8 weeks old, or a laying hen that you eat at McDonald's and McNuggets. We're talking about extremely colorful, purebred genetic birds that have been bred over the years, such as Rhode Island Reds, Plymouth Rocks, New Hampshire's, Delaware's. Then you have, there's many different classes of purebred poultry, including the waterfowl and heritage turkeys.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. So you have members of your group that keep and maintain these herds
Absolutely.
Of chickens then? Okay.
Absolutely.
Mr. Rademacher.
I've been doing this for 41 years. There's two particular breeds that I raise. Black Monarchas is one. The bird would, if I had one here, it would take up half this desk. You don't see those anymore. You know, there's only two breeders in the United States. There's a number of them in Canada yet. There's two of us that specialize in that particular breed of bird. And so I'm licensed as a hatchery in the state of Minnesota. I donate chicks to 4-H'ers so that they have projects. A lot of these youngsters don't have winter facilities, so they might bring a few birds back, or some of them will dress them out, use them for, put them in the freezer. But it's all basically centered around heritage birds, and that's what we promote.
Mr. Chairman, we are in the purebred breeding business is what we, and showing of our purebred poultry is what we do.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I do recall, and I'm seeing some of those birds in my past. My parents, the Linton Farm Hatchery in Northfield, mm-hmm. remember that? Are there many hatcheries left, or how many are there in the state?
I can't answer that directly. Most of them are commercial. They're either layers or broiler hatcheries. You have Strongbergs up at Pine City, is it? It's up north. He specializes in the purebred birds. Most of them are in Missouri, Iowa. The purebred breeding, Murray McMurray is a very common name. They specialize in all the rare breeds of poultry and waterfowl. So,
Representative Fritz. All right.
Thank you.
So, seeing no further questions, thank you so much for taking the time and providing your testimony.
Thank you,
very
Mr.
interesting.
Chairman.
Thank you. Next on the list will be Mr. Crabtree. And Mr. Polk, you'll be up after this. So please state your name and who you represent for the record and begin, please.
Chairman Hamilton and members of the committee, good morning. My name is John Crabtree. I'm the assistant director of the Northern Crop Institute. We are located in Fargo, up in the Red River Valley. You have a one-page document in front of you. It says Northern Crop Institute supporting Minnesota agriculture. I'm going to make it short, but there's a couple of key areas that maybe some of you maybe don't fully quite understand, the Northern Crop Institute. We are a very unique organization. In fact, there's only three other organizations like us in the world. The NCI, or Northern Crop Institute, was established in 1981 to support regional agriculture and value-add processing by conducting educational and technical programs that expand and maintain domestic and international markets for northern grown crops. In other words, we want to make sure people, when they come to this region, whether they're grain buyers or end users, that they fully understand the kinds of crops that we grow in this region, how they can be purchased and processed. We all know how important agriculture is to this northern plains. And when I talk about the northern plains, you'll notice on our logo, it has four states, and we're funded by four states, the Dakotas, Minnesota, and Montana. We were established in 1981 to educate these people from around the world and here in the United States. And when we started building the Institute, and just for information, the Northern Crop Institute is located on the campus of North Dakota State University. We're not an academic unit of the university. We are under State Board of Higher Education, but we have a board of directors. There's 16 members, and they represent the four states. Here in the state of Minnesota, we have a soybean grower from Northwest Minnesota that represents the state of Minnesota. Now, since we opened our doors, we've had close to 130 countries through the Institute. And what better way in which, you know, producers can promote their crops? Just think if an individual farmer had to travel to 130 countries to promote his particular crop, it would be just about impossible. So really, we're a facilitator for a lot of the commodity groups in the four states. In other words, here in the state of Minnesota, we receive funds not only through the state dollars that you provide, we also provide get dollars from, say, from Minnesota Soybean Council, the Minnesota Corn Council, and also the Wheat Council to help their promote their particular commodity. Now, one of the things one of the major activities is we put on these educational courses. You'll notice on the back of this sheet, it lists some of the educational program highlights. Talking about various commodities, the quality and utilization of these crops to educate these people. Because if they're coming here to buy grains from us, they need to understand the pricing of these grains, the quality of these grains, and how to process these commodities. And so we host a number of courses. One of the big ones that we have, and earlier this morning in the testimony, we were talking about a farmer with the corn prices and so forth. One of the things that we do, we want to make sure people understand our grain marking system here. Those of you that are farmers, you know about the grading system when you take your grain into the elevator and they measure for protein and moisture and so forth. We want to make sure that the grain buyers understand when they come to purchase from the United States the quality of these crops, what the pricing, and we have a course called Grain Procurement. In fact, last year we had over 20 nations represented. So our institute is sort of kind of admitted in many United Nations. We have a 30-seat auditorium that has simultaneous translation, and so it's worked out very functional. The other key activity that we do is that we work with the feed and food processing industries. Just to give an example, here in the state of Minnesota, we've worked with several multinational companies right here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. In other words, in which they can do their product development work. They're looking at a new product. In fact, there are a number of food products in the supermarkets right here in the Twin Cities that we have helped to develop with these food companies. And these are done under confidentiality agreements.
Now, on conclusion, talking about the funding, we receive state dollars. In fact, about 40 to 45% of our funding is hard dollars from the state of North Dakota. The rest of the dollars is state dollars from the state of South Dakota. In Montana, it's through the Montana Wheat and Barley Committee. And the rest of the dollars, then, is what we call soft dollars through the commodity groups. And those dollars can vary from year to year, depend on the quality of the crop or the, you know, the production that they have. Now, for here in Minnesota, beside the commodity groups, we have received dollars through the Minnesota Department of Agriculture since about 1982, 83. In fact, when we first opened our doors here. So we've had a great relationship with the state of Minnesota. The other thing with our funding is that it's critical. We have 11 staff, and not all these staff have hard dollars. So we're very dependent on soft dollars to pay for some of those salaries. In addition, these funds that we receive is a great leverage when we go to these other states, because they want to see the partnerships with the four states. And so what we provide, what the state of Minnesota provides, you know, when we go to these other states, they say, well, we receive dollars from the state of Minnesota, we have this partnership, and that's one thing that we want to continue. We've had a great relationship. Like I say, it goes back to 1983.
Mr. Crabtree, mm-hmm. to that point, do you have the dollar amounts that the other states contribute? You said you're located, your office in
North Dakota State University.
Right. And North Dakota funds, according to this, about 42%.
Yeah.
Do you have the dollar amounts that Montana and South Dakota contribute?
Well, through South Dakota, the state of South Dakota is around $75,000 to $80,000.
Okay.
And in Montana, it will run, we don't know for sure, but usually runs in at $70,000 to $75,000 range. Our total budget is about $1.5 million.
Okay. And Montana about 75,000,
yes,
you think, and South Dakota about 70,000 to 75,000,
right,
as well. And Minnesota, we have how many people that represent Minnesota serving on that board?
There's just one person.
Okay, and how many people serve on that board?
We have 16 board members.
Okay.
And they are farmers, and they're also food processors.
Okay.
They represent the council. We report to this board. On a day-to-day operation, we do have to report to the Vice President of Agriculture for the NDSU.
Okay. Okay. Any further questions, members?
If you have a chance to come to Fargo after we have the flood, I encourage you to stop by, because it is quite a unique facility. We have a processing equipment, feed mill, bakery, so it is quite unique.
Okay. So, well, thank you so much for your testimony.
Well, it was a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, appreciate you driving in.
No, that's not a problem.
Very well. Thank you. Mr. Polk, please. So, welcome. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Polk. I'm the current Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota Livestock Breeders Association, which is a umbrella organization that encompasses the purebred industries, livestock industries in Minnesota, the Angus, the Holstein, the Duroc's, the Jerseys, the Hampshire Sheep, those types of organizations. Currently, there's 25 breed organizations that are represented on the livestock breeders, and it encompasses about 2,800 members totally within those organizations. They include beef cattle, dairy goats, swine, sheep, and draft horses. The organization actually began back in 1896, so they go back a few years. I believe the funding started right around 1930 from the state for the livestock breeders, and for the past about 30 years, the organization received about $19,000 from the state. Last year was 18 because of budget cuts, so it's been pretty stable in that time frame. Throughout the existence of the organization, it's been dedicated to the promotion of the long-term best interests of livestock breeders and producers in the state, and to represent them in their solution of common problems. Some of the things it did early on was to help organize the Livestock Sanitary Board, currently known as Board of Animal Health. It also formed the Junior Livestock Show back in 1918. Today it's known as the Minnesota 4-H Auction, and it's held at the Minnesota State Fair. It's still held. It was held in South St. Paul for a number of years. Now it's at the State Fair. All the people that help run that are all volunteers. They're board members and some people from the throughout the state that basically volunteer to serve on that group. None of the board members receive any compensation for their time or their travel. We have a one person that's a paid staff member, that's me. The remainder of the grant dollars go towards programming. Some of the things that the board does, one of the major things that it does, and we do it on an annual basis, is put on a judging conference to teach people how to judge at shows. You might think that's a pretty easy thing to do, but there are things that these people need to know about how to treat young people in the show ring, give them some hints, how to select a state fair lineup, what to look for. Most of them know what to look for in the animals, but there's a lot of other little things that go into judging. So there's a conference this summer that's basically a Midwest regional conference that will train people on how to judge dairy cattle, for instance. Next year it might be swine, it might be beef, it might be sheep, so we rotate them. So that's one of the major things they do. Some of the financial support that comes to the organizations goes to youth judging team traveling to national contests. Both FFA and 4-H receive support in this area. Some seed money goes to counties throughout the state for educational programs that are relative to agriculture in their particular area of the state. Some of them are putting on programs to teach young people how to train rabbits, for instance, or how to grow rabbits. Some of them are for horses. I mean, it varies on the application, and all these applications that come in have to go through a committee process, and once the program has been accomplished, they send in some evaluation on it, and then they get their money. So they don't automatically get the money. It has to go through a process. There are currently many requirements being placed upon livestock producers to market animals. One of these currently is the Livestock Quality Assurance Program. The board works with 4-H and FFA and combines it with the Youth Ethics Program to train people to follow the steps so they can market animals. And there's a certificate they receive once they've gone through the whole process. So they, for instance, if they want to show at the state fair, they have to send in this copy of their certificate so they're certified to even show at the fair to market animals at the state fair. Consumer education relative to agriculture, most particularly livestock, are our major focus today of the board, and it has invested in a number of these programs, including Minnesota Ag in the Classroom. I'm sure you're all familiar with that one. The Birthing Center at the State Fair, the Moo Booth Project at the State Fair, the Minnesota Ag Ambassador Institute, Minnesota State Dairy Camp, and a variety of others. Another large focus recently has been peer mentoring at the state fair where young people are trained to be in the barns and educate consumers about agriculture and livestock, most particularly. Any of you that are in livestock, I think most of you are, know that consumers are getting less and less educated about animals, and we need that education. They need to know where their food comes from.
Mr. Polk, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right.
And yes, that's sir. A big part of the focus right now.
Mr. Polk, what's your total budget?
Well, the total budget of the organization is around $75,000, but it's somewhat misleading in that a bulk of it is generated through the auction and the 4-H Dairy Showcase, and those funds are dedicated, the 20% generated from those programs are dedicated to 4-H programming and FFA programming, youth programming, basically, yes, in the state, and to pay the expenses of putting on those two programs.
You put a strong emphasis on ag literacy, youth education, and educate the public as far as who we are and what we do in agriculture.
Right.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay. Do we have any questions, members, for the testifier? Mr. Polk, thank you so much for coming before us. We appreciate that and driving in. Where did you say home is?
My home is actually Marine on St. Croix, so I'm not very far away.
So, yeah, all right. Very well. Very well. Well, we appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right. Everybody.
Thank you. Next, we will bring up about Second Harvest Heartland. Welcome. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Newell Searle. I'm the Vice President of Second Harvest Heartland, and I'm speaking on behalf of Second Harvest Heartland as well as the five other Second Harvest Feeding America food banks that serve Minnesota. And it's a pleasure to be in front of this committee again. I've been here many times before, not only as Second Harvest, but an earlier career as a Deputy Commissioner of Agriculture.
And Mr. Searle, you've, like you said, you've testified before us, and I think most members understand what Second Harvest is and what we do. In particular, you receive a grant here, and that is, could you provide testimony around that, please?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will. Since 2005, the legislature has provided a grant through the Department of Agriculture for the purchase of milk produced and processed in Minnesota for distribution through food shelves and emergency food programs. The current appropriation is $1 million for the biennium. It is shared equitably among the six food banks using the formula used by USDA for the distribution of surplus commodities, otherwise known as TFAP, and it's a allocation based on the number of people in poverty in the respective county areas that each food bank serves. The funds are used, the other food banks are located, by the way, in Rochester, Duluth, Grand Rapids, Crookston, and the food bank in Fargo serves Clay County, Minnesota. The milk is purchased through an annual low bid process, and the funds, each food bank makes its own low bid with its local dairy processors. 100% of the money does go for milk, although there is an allowance for administration. Second Harvest Heartland is the fiscal agent, and we absorb the administrative costs ourselves so that we can use the money for milk. Milk is one of the most cost-effective foods, and especially for good nutrition for children. In our effort to prevent hunger and poor nutrition, we rely on donated food. Most of it comes in shelf-stable form. Milk is one of those fresh foods that is a nutritional complement to shelf-stable food. It's not something that can be donated by households and individuals in any quantity, and there's always a food safety issue with perishable product that is being donated unless you have a special care and handling. Milk contains the vitamins and minerals that your mother always told you about. I won't even go into that. A recent study by the University of Minnesota Food Industry Center found that the cost of hunger to the economy of Minnesota is about $1.6 billion. Poor nutrition results in very high but preventable medical costs, much of which is paid for by public funds, which comes through a committee that at least five of you in this room sit on, the Health and Human Services Committee. Another $238 million a year is estimated to come from remedial education or kids who flunk grades, flunk classes, have to be re-educated. There's a lot of abundant literature in that kids who don't have good nutrition and don't eat don't learn. And this, again, is a preventable cost. So the milk provides a very important ingredient in our effort to prevent hunger. 80,000 people a week come to food shelves. It's doubled since 2005. And as one of the food banks said, we can't keep up with the demand for milk. In Minnesota, at least, milk is a very high-priced product because not only is it regulated by the federal milk marketing orders, but we also have regulations in the state about the retail of milk. So you will not find a fire sale on milk anywhere in Minnesota. Our data shows that the cost, the low bid costs, have ranged from $2.03 a gallon to $2.70 a gallon. Currently, our contract is at for $2.40 a gallon. This is a lot of money for a family on a $22,000 a year income or less. And so without this program, there probably would not be much milk, if any, available through the food shelves in Minnesota.
So, Mr. Searle, as far as management of that, do you experience any shrinkage or waste when you're bringing in a perishable product such as milk onto the shelves?
Mr. Chairman, no, we don't in this case because milk is one of those, it lasts a certain period of time. So by being able to purchase it, we can time the purchase with deliveries in the logistics that we run so that we have the minimal amount of, time lost between the time that it is processed and the time that it reaches the shelf. We do not hold it in inventory 1 minute longer than necessary.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I heard the numbers right here. Yeah, sorry. did I hear you said 80,000 a week use food shelf?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Representative Purcell, yes.
Representative Purcell.
And you said that had doubled. That 80,000 represents today's number, so it was 40,000, and it's... Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Purcell, yes, that's right. It's doubled since 2005.
Thank you.
Representative Purcell, all right, thank you. And could you walk us, Representative Fritz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question, just pop. How often do you run out of milk?
Mr. Searle.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fritz, off the top of my head, I can't say how often we ran out of milk. We do run out of milk, yes. And the amount that we're able to purchase will meet the need for 6-7 months at current run rates. When it first started, we were pretty close to meeting the need, but the need has gone up.
Thank you.
Representative Fritz. And any further questions for the testifier? Representative Swazinski.
Mr. Chair, just could you go over what areas of the state you cover again?
Mr. Chairman, yes, Second Harvest, the six food banks cover the whole state. We cover every county in the state. Second Harvest Heartland itself covers 41 counties. If you start in the corner with Minnesota, Iowa, South Dakota, down in Rock County, we go up to Swift, Big Stone, kind of across to Todd Morrison, and we kind of jog down and skip Mille Lac. That's covered by Grand Rapids, and we go all the way over. We cover the metro, and we go south through Le Sueur, Blue Earth, Watonwan, and Jackson, Martin, Noble. So it's 41 counties, Southwest Metro, East Central, and the other food banks serve other areas, other county areas. We are by far the largest in the state and one of the largest in the country.
Representative Anderson, Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Searle, you said $1 million for the biennium. Does that is that total states, or does that include federal funding, too?
Mr. Searle.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, that is just from the state of Minnesota. We do not receive federal funding at all, with the exception of administrative money to administer one of the federal nutrition programs, which is a boxed product program, which goes largely to seniors, and it's a very small program. And that one comes through the Department of Health.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Right. Representative Anderson Paul.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. This too is an outstanding program, and following up on Representative Swazinski's, so this is available statewide for all people in Minnesota, correct?
Mr. Searle.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, yes, that's right. It is available through the emergency food system throughout the state.
Mr. Anderson. All right, seeing no further questions, I want to thank you so much for your testimony, and we know how to get a hold of you as well if we have any additional questions, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always a pleasure.
All right. I'll call on Mr. Schoenfeld, if you'd like to make your way up front. And then Mr. Boerboom, we'll have Deputy Commissioner come up and answer a few questions. And then also there's a few individuals that cannot make it to testify on behalf, so I might direct some of the questions towards you, if that's okay, Deputy Commissioner. So, Mr. Schoenfeld, welcome. State your name for the record, who you represent, and begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. Today I'm working with the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs. And let me tell you, first of all, that there are 95 county fairs across the state for 87 counties. Some of the fairs have a few more. I must say that I did just notice in my notes here that one of them had dropped off, so we may be down one from that. But in any case, there are areas of the state, like St. Louis County is an example, because of the largeness, has got, I believe, three fairs in that particular county. The area of the pass-through that we're talking about here is state aid goes to county fairs. It is a number that, Mr. Chairman, you may have a better number than I. The last number I had was $474,000 per year. I think because of the unallotment, that number may have decreased by 3 or 6%, I think. So it may be a little smaller than that, but that's the last number I had. I guess I'd point out, with relative to fairs, I think it's something that we oftentimes take for granted. It has a long tradition. The first territorial legislature, one of the first things they did was to enact legislation to allow for the creation of county agricultural societies. So the heritage and the history of county fairs goes back to the beginning of our state. And they were very important back in those days because we were such an agricultural state, and they continue to be important. And I guess I'd like to point out a few things about it. First of all, the funds that come through this committee for this area are statewide. Every county in the state, it's not something that is zeroed in a particular area. Secondly, it is one of the major interfaces, I think, between rural and urban that we still have, where both urban and rural come together and learn from each other. And I think earlier you talked about agricultural literacy and some of those kinds of things, and this is part of it. Secondly, I think one of the major things that our fairs try to do is that they have a mission to educate. And they try to educate, they provide those linkages between rural and urban. They exhibit our cultural and historical heritage. And they provide an opportunity for competition, creative, not only with livestock and crops and things like that, but also in areas like creative arts, as an example. And they apply to the youngest kids that are in 4-H and FFA up to the senior citizens that participate in open class, and those are where these funds end up going. Generations of family tradition, and you may be surprised to note that we actually receive more people through the gate at county fairs than go through our state fair. So that we have over 3 million people that go through our county fairs across our state. If you look at the numbers, to give you an idea how these funds are distributed, we have a specific chapter of law called Chapter 38 that is statutorily designates how these funds are distributed. And Basically what it says, as used herein, the term premium, and these funds do help for pay for premiums and the 4-H program and FFA program in particular, in competition and exhibits. As used herein, the term premium shall mean the cash award paid to an exhibitor for the merit of an exhibit of livestock, livestock products, grains, fruits, flowers, vegetables, articles of domestic science, handicrafts, hobbies, fine arts, other products of a creative nature, and articles made by school pupils, or the cash awards paid to the merit winner of events such as 4-H or future farmer contests. These are the things that does not go to. None of these funds are available for awards for horse races, horse pulls, tractor pulls, demolition derbies, automobile or other racing, jackpot premiums, ball games, musical contests, and so forth. So it's not available for any of those kinds of things, and it does not go to the carnival at the fair. It's available straight to the 4-H kids, the FFA kids, and those that participate in open class. So we understand that. Give you some idea, in the statute, it sets up what the state would pay to individual fairs based upon the number of exhibitors, and the exhibits at a fair are really the center point of a fair. That is really the purpose of it. It's not the carnival rides or even the how many foods on a stick you can buy, but it is the exhibitors and the competition. And with regard to that, in fiscal year 2011, according to the statutory provisions that state how these funds are to be paid, the amount of appropriation that was available in 2011 paid for 91.7% of what the statute calls for. Now, there is a provision in the statute that says that if there isn't enough money appropriated, that it would be prorated to the individual fairs, and that's in fact what happens. To give you an idea for some of you, I guess I didn't know what specific counties, or maybe I would have picked it out, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't sure which county you were in. But in any case, to give you some idea of the distribution of the funds, there are kind of three categories of areas, and it's all based upon the number of exhibitors at the fair. It's not necessarily based upon the number of people that come through the gate or the size or how big a carnival they have or anything like that. It's based upon the number of exhibitors. And to give you an idea of the range of this, the very smallest county recipient in the state is the North Ohm Fair at Kuchiching, which I have not been to, but it must be fairly small. They received $549 in 2011, so fairly small amount. The largest fair in terms of the amount of funds they received through this was Scott County in Jordan. Evidently a fairly significant number of exhibitors there, and they had a prorated share of $23,145. That was the largest. To give you some other ideas of other large counties, the Steel County Fair is the largest fair in the state in terms of gate. It's, you know, it approaches the state fair in some ways in terms of what, if any of you have ever seen it, it's a quite a magnificent fair. And the Steel County Fair received $15,470. And then if you were to look at some of the more, probably on average they're somewhere around $5,000 to $7,000. And if you were to look at more mid-range counties, for instance, Redwood Falls, Redwood County Fair, $3,563 is kind of a mid-range or lower end of the mid-range. If you were to look at Winona, it's at about $5,500. The Howard Lake Wright County Fair is at $7,000 and so forth. Those are kind of mid-range in where those numbers come out. But as I indicated before, it goes to all the fairs in the state.
Yeah. Representative Schoenfeld, we do have a question. Representative Kath.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not as much a question, just as a comment here. As the proud representative for Steele County, I want to say that we are the you know, the largest county free fair, and we are the fair with flair. And so I want to make sure that we can get everybody down to Steele County for that. But I think that's really important to recognize, is that our fair board for years has been trying to promote it as a free fair and keeping it as a free fair. And this type of funding, where you can bring it in and incentivize people to come in and exhibit, really does keep that that crowd coming, and making sure that we can promote that leadership and that educational development through those programs, but also keep our fairs free, so then that way all community members can participate in it. So it's great, and I thank you for the advocacy, and very very honored to be working with our Ag Society and the work that they do.
Thank you. So Any other questions, members? Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, there's just one last comment that I'd like to add, if I could. And that is that I every year am amazed when I do represent these people. It's my best contract in one way and pays the least in the other hand. But but in any case, I really appreciate working with the folks that volunteer for these fairs. And every year in January, and you as politicians might want to take note of this, because we have asked politicians to come to our annual convention to see what it is we do, and we never get anybody ever showing up. Now, we haven't asked blanket, I'll tell you that. So not every one of you have been asked, but some of you have been asked occasionally. And what amazes me is that there are 1,400 volunteers that show up in Bloomington for their annual convention. 1,400. There aren't many places, probably, where you're going to get 1,400 constituents that go across every county in the state. And to me, an amazing thing in terms of the volunteerism that is associated with these fairs, with the county fair boards and so forth. And so with that, I think you get a lot of bang for the buck when you spend money in this area for the youth and the education, the agricultural literacy and so forth, because these people are volunteers. There's very few paid people that work with county fairs, so just wanted to mention it.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski.
Maybe you already answered this, Mr. Chair. The question is, how many county fairs are there?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chair, without going back and counting the list, I've got 95 written at the top, but I see that there's one or two that have dropped out, so it might be down to 93 now. But there are more county fairs than there are counties.
Yeah. So, and to answer your first question, Mr. Schoenfeld, we have on the spreadsheet 474,000 per year.
Okay.
So, yeah, very close. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Schoenfeld. Appreciate your testimony. And at this time, we'll call up the Deputy Commissioner. We heard some of the testimony on the Farm Crisis Assistance. There's a few others that we haven't heard from, the Dairy Development Program. And so if you'd like to comment on some of those, the Farm Market Nutrition as well. So if you could comment on a couple of those.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Jim Borbom, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I'll be respectful of your time. I know that you're short, but just to call your attention, there's a handout in your packet that talks about the Minnesota Farm Advocates. The Minnesota Farm Advocates is that farm crisis assistance line item that you see on your spreadsheet. That is $180,000 per year, or $360,000 for the biennium. Just to point out a couple highlights, this program again provides one-on-one assistance to Minnesota farm families who are facing some type of financial adversity. The cost of these families, there is no cost for the service, and we have 9 farm advocates that we contract with throughout the state of Minnesota. They are trained in lending practices, mediation, disaster programs. They recognize the need for referral services if there's a need to move someone to either counseling services or legal services. They're also quite familiar with bankruptcy laws, USDA farm programs, and FSA programs as well. In the middle of the brochure, there's a couple of examples of when you should see or use a farm advocate, and I'll just highlight two or three points here. One of the most significant impacts in a farm business is when you exit the business or when you bring new family members in. And so if you're going into a partnership or somehow creating a transition in the operation, there's tax consequences, and it's good to bring people in to make sure you understand the consequences on those decisions. Also, if there's a partial liquidation or some sale of the farming business, then again, this is a good example when you could use their services. So that's just a very quick snapshot of the Farm Advocate Program. Again, it's been something that we've administered since 1984, and we have 9 people throughout the state that we do issue a request for proposal, and so we have had some of the same people in this program for 20 to 25 years. We have a very consistent track record with the people that participate in this program. We're actually looking for new people as we will issue another round of proposals sometime this spring, so it's always good to see new people come into the program. Happy to talk about a couple of the other pass-through grants of the agency. And
if you would, please. The Dairy Development Program, the Farm Market Nutrition Program, and the Native Plant Research.
Okay. Let me talk about the Dairy Development Program. That was a program that's been in existence for more than 10 years. It started out at $1 million per year was the base appropriation. As you can see on the spreadsheet right now, that's down to $634,000 per year, or $1.268 million for the biennium. There are two primary activities under this dairy development program. The first is a dairy diagnostic teams. These are team members that are essentially coordinated by a facilitator or someone that administers these dairy diagnostic teams. There are volunteers that participate. They can be farm management people, building specialists, or nutritionists that it can help farm families, dairy farmers work through some of the issues that they might be facing if they're seeing either a drop in production or some other herd health issue that they might be dealing with. A second part of that dairy development program is our dairy business planning grants, where the state will match funds up to $5,000. This is a 50-50 match. This goes to a dairy producer who is looking to upgrade or expand, or again bring in making a change in the operation. Best practice there is to have some plans in place before you make those changes, and we can help cover the cost of those grants. It's up to the farmer to contract out with a consultant or someone that they want to work with. So that's just a quick snapshot on that. We've got lots of information on our website, and I can certainly provide additional supporting information about the dairy development program.
Just a question, any of the other commodities, hogs, poultry, anything like that, beef, are there developmental programs for them as well?
That's a great question, Mr. Chairman. We've had conversations about expanding that model to other livestock sectors, and at the present time, we have not, but there is a need, obviously. As you know, the pork industry and the beef industry have certainly fallen on some hard times, as well as the dairy industry, so we do recognize that need.
And since this program has been in place, have the number of dairy cows gone up or down in the state?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the number of cows, I have to check on that, I don't know, but I believe that actually the number of cows may have gone up. The number of producers has gone down. There's a significant drop in the number of producers. We're probably at about 4,500 dairy farms in the state at the present time, and I would hate to guess where we were 10 years ago, but I can get that information.
If you would. I mean, it's just people are asking what are the returns on investment that we have around here as well. So thank you.
Just to comment, and again, one of the other line items on your spreadsheet is, I'm trying to find that number right now, but it's a farmer's market nutrition program. I see it's number 373-644. That's $177,000 a year. And just to let you know how that program works, this is, again, coupons to low-income families for the purchase of local-grown produce through farmer's markets. And this is a state-funded program matched by federal dollars, and again, the benefit is low-income families have the option to purchase locally grown fresh produce through farmers markets, and I can issue a lot more information or report on that.
And that's been in existence for how long?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure how long. It's been in existence as long as I've been with the agency, which is more than 15 years, so it's quite a while.
Thank you. And the other one that we had a question on was the native plant research. Or was that,
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to, I'm not familiar with that one, so let me get some further information. If I could send that to you electronically, I'd be happy to do that.
Yes, that'd be great. Any questions for the testifiers, members? So, Deputy Commissioner, I thank you for your testimony. We know how to get a hold of you as well.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Members, we covered a lot of ground here today. I appreciate your patience as well. We ran 5 minutes over, so thank you so much for that. Again, a reminder, we're not going to meet tomorrow. I'll be in direct conversations with Representative Eakin as well to finalize some of the things that we'll be talking about as far as the budget all of next week. All right? Thank you. With that, meeting adjourned.